For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight, our Tenzo, our chief Fogetsu, is going to give the talk. So, Tenzo's in the house. Thank you.
Tenzo is in the house instead of the kitchen. Once in a while, they let me out. Is that thing happening?
It's happening.
Okay. Can you believe this is a sign of my laziness that I still have not figured out how to work that thing? We've been here over a year.
It's delegating.
Yes. Thank you for rescuing me, Laurel, but I might have some laziness happening. So, good evening, Bodhisattvas.
Good evening.
How is your practice going? Do you know what your practice is? I hope so. Oh. Anything anyone wants to bring up before I start blabbing? Okay. But if you want to bring something up, please do, because, you know, everything I say is ridiculous and extra. So.
Stop bragging.
I can't help it.
Actually, I have something.
Oh, thank you, Renee.
It's spring and I have new kittens.
Oh, how many?
Two. Oh, and Dharma.
Oh my gosh.
Hurrah.
It's great. Thanks. I'm also really, you know, happy that you brought up something personal, because I think what we're doing is something very personal, and, you know, already I have this thing like, beyond thinking, you know, I'm going to read from this by Zen Master Dogen, you know, from 13th century Japan. It feels like a long time ago. And removed sometimes. So my hope with my blabbing is maybe to activate the personal nature of practice. So as many of you may know, who've been around for a while, I have been practicing with the winter of my discontent with practice. You know, my practice has been feeling kind of icky, shabby, ragged. Despite, you know, probably 16 yards of wonderful fabric that I'm surrounded in. Tygon and I probably together could open up a fabric store. You know, underneath all that is you know, I'm dealing with the same kind of First Noble Truth issue of suffering that I think most everyone here probably is on some level, despite the blossoming of spring. Do you think this could actually be a peach branch, peach blossom? That's what it says in the store, but I don't know. What do y'all know about
it
this kind
like
of thing?
A waxberry.
Hmm?
It looks like a waxberry.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure.
A horticulturist here. Laurel?
I bet it is, if they said it is. Yeah, I can't see.
Okay, sorry. Okay.
But I don't see why they would make that up.
Well, because there was an ambiguous labeling. It said various branches. Then there was something that said P-E-A-C.
Oh,
it's a peach tree.
Oh, jeez. Okay. So whatever it is, I kind of thought it was part of our spring, you know, spring fest. And about half of us were sitting last week, yesterday. About half of us had a sesshin, a one-day sitting event. And so... a lot of this is going to be a repeat, because I confessed to Tygon that actually what he was talking about was what I was figuring out talking about tonight, and I said, you know, I'm kind of lazy. Would it be okay if I talked about this? And he's like, yeah.
So, no, I said there's lots more to say.
You did. That's true. I misspoke. But anyway, so, you know, I've been in he talked a lot about blossoming, but I've actually been in kind of a withering phase of practice. And despite the springtime, I don't see any blooms coming anytime soon in my practice, I must say. But, you know, I also feel at the same time somewhat happy when my practice doesn't feel so good. Because it gives me an opportunity to explore that experience and not get too settled in one place, you might say. So, you know, I kept thinking about, you know, how does a state of discontent arise? You know, I have, like, the most amazing life, I think, I can imagine for myself. And still, you know, I'm complaining that my, you know, investments aren't coming back as quickly as I'd like them to in dharmic practice. So, you know, I think, what is it that blossoms? What is it that withers? You know, what's the right effort in this practice? And, you know, what still nags at me? So I think those are pretty good questions. I don't really have a lot of answers to it, but I have some hints that the ancestors have sort of bestowed upon us, I think. So last Sunday, yesterday, Taigen was quoting this 13th century Japanese teacher, Dogen, the founder of our school in Japan, and of Soto Zen. And Dogen's text, this fabulous fascicle called Dragon Song. Some people translate it as Dragon Howl, you know, since we're all dragons. You know, dragons are kind of what symbols of good practitioners or, you know, strong practitioners. But I like the Dragon Song. That was Mel's, I guess, translation with Kaz. But I like the dragon singing. So there's this little tale within this writing of Dogen. So Dogen dredges up these old teaching stories, you know, and some of you might be familiar with Zen teaching stories. They sort of have this form that some student or seeker or monk who asks a question of a teacher and the teacher responds. Often the question's very sincere and kind of, you know, open, and the teacher often says something that is bizarre, confounding, you know, usually kind of bug people, or some people like really like them and find them enlightening and intriguing, but some of them seem like, you know, some people don't like them and find them annoying. So choice is yours. But so here's the little story, little tale that Dogen quotes. A monk approaches a teacher and asks, "What is the way?" It's my favorite, like, I think one of my favorite Zen questions, right? What is the way? And I think it means like the way down to downtown Chicago. But, you know, it's like, maybe that's what they're asking. So the teacher, in this case, a Chinese teacher, responds, "A dragon singing in a withered tree." And the monk replies, "I don't understand." It's like, what the hell? And the teacher clarifies by saying, "An eyeball in the skull." So much for that one. So Dogen, these kind of tales, the same question or the same theme comes up again. And probably this monk staggered off and talked to his Dharma brothers, maybe his Dharma sisters as well, about this. Because Dogen follows this up with yet another encounter. Some monk brings up the issue again with another old Chinese teacher. So this monk, maybe a different monk, I don't know, says, "What is a dragon singing in a withered tree?" The teacher answers, "It still holds joy." It's joy in the withered tree. The monk seems okay with that. The monk then said, "What is the eyeball in the skull?" And the teacher answers, "Still, it holds consciousness." I kind of like that, actually. You know, this withered, think of a withered skull, kind of a scary thing, some eyeball. It's almost like some kind of horror movie. But that's awareness. You know, still in our withering, there is a mind that is open and aware and seeing things as they are. So Dogen continues on and quotes yet another story along this theme. So, you know, clearly people must have been chewing on this. I can imagine like all these like monks walking around, you know, downtown or, you know, through some kind of dusty road going, yeah, you know, this guy talked about this withered skull and this withered tree and a dragon singing and an eyeball holding consciousness, you know. So another encounter happens. Another monk says to a teacher, I wonder what kind of song the dragon sings. And this third teacher says, no one knows what kind of song the dragon sings, but those who hear it lose their lives. So bodhisattvas, are you ready to lose your lives to hear your dragon song? And what does it mean to lose a life? To hear the Buddha humming along that is coming up from your own practice. As we cruise through this world of endurance, you know, the traditional name for the Buddha field, the world we live in, is endurance, the Saha world. So, you know, life is a little bit tough for us. And I think it takes a lot of courage and heroism, really, to face the life that we have with some kind of flexibility and openness and caring, and to be able to hear the song of our own dragon, you might say, but also how that's harmonizing with all the dragons out there, seen and unseen. So I think this kind of courage, you know, I don't know, a lot of times it's not talked about in Zen very explicitly, but we chanted the Heart Sutra tonight, which is a condensation of a literature called the Prajnaparamita, or the Perfection of Wisdom literature, which is about this eye that's seeing through the skull, and which is our own seeing the world as it really is, not what we're trying to make it to be. So one of my favorite... So this Heart Sutra is what we chant. It's a sort of like a condensation or a distillation of this whole gigantic literature that, you know, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva saw that all five skandhas are empty. You know, it doesn't mean like an empty vessel. It actually means empty of an independent self. So that we're all interconnected is, you know, we're all blooming together off of this branch that's like intertwined over, you know, space and time and the whole universe. That's kind of what that means. So I think sometimes when we read the Prajnaparamita, it kind of pares things down a lot. But anyway, to have the kind of wisdom that Buddhism talks about is a big deal, because it's pretty overwhelming to give up our ideas about the way things are. That everything we see, touch, and feel is exactly the way things are, and to give up our self-importance. So my favorite rendition, or my favorite version of the Prajnaparamita, is something called the Ratnaguna Prajnaparamita, which is a verse commentary of the Prajnaparamita in 8,000 lines. And it starts off with a little admonition. And this is one of my favorite things. So this is, if you want to hear the dragon howl, first be warned. The admonition says, call forth as much as you can of love, of respect, and of faith. So these are kind of resources that that maybe we need in order to wither. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all of your taints. So this is some of the withering. This is what we clear away. I'll say more about that. But set aside your edges and listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, which is, of course, Buddha's song, taught for the well-being of the world, for heroic spirits intended. So this is how we heal the world. But I think just in those little, so that's sort of like, okay, if you want to actually do this practice, you better sort of call forth everything you have inside of you that's open and strong and caring, and get ready to give up what you think is your life. So one of the first things that gets encountered, I think, on this path is suffering. So that monk probably going, what is the way? It was like, what is the way out of all of this suffering? Or what is the way to the heart of compassion? And, you know, in these circumstances, I think Buddha's advice is usually enter your problem situation wholeheartedly. So when we're having difficulties, you know, enter it wholeheartedly. The Eightfold Path, you know, which is the Fourth Noble Truth, right? Way out of suffering, is actually to be upright in the midst of suffering. Maybe if we're pretty upright, we can actually ask a question like, what is the way? You know, that's such a great question. But anyway, my sense is that when we start to open to our lives and we open a practice, difficulty arises in some way. So I myself have been having some difficulty. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, I'm sure I'm not alone in that matter. Recently, I had a very difficult kind of set of circumstances in my work life. And one of the things I noticed is that after all these years of practice, I was encountering a lot of hindrances. You know, things came up, like, you know, when we chanted the Heart Sutra, it said, you know, without any hindrance, there is no fear, but actually I was experiencing a lot of fear, and hindrances arise. And you might know what the five hindrances are. Can anyone name them? So hindrances, by the way, are called nivaranas, not nirvana, not to be confused with nirvana, but they're like varnishes, coverings over enlightening. They're obstacles. Remember it said to remove all the defilements and obstacles. So the five hindrances, this is a way to practice, actually. This is a way to wither, is encountering something like a hindrance. So the first one is sensual desire. And that can be like, you know, all of our senses grabbing onto things. So the way I noticed my desire manifesting when I was struggling with this difficult situation was I developed this addiction to science fiction. So I would come home from work. I would either immerse myself in a science fiction book or turn on Hulu on my laptop, crawl into bed, and watch science fiction video, anything I could get a hold of. Now, this is somewhat unusual behavior for me, although I've always loved science fiction novels. Graduating to television was something new for me, since most people might know I didn't own really a television my adult life. So, but my laptop turned into one. So, but this is my eye object, you know, and my eye faculty grabbing onto this object, you know, and kind of escaping. But that wasn't the only thing. So the second one is ill will of the five hindrances. You know, I found myself filled with rage, you know, at my boss, actually. And no matter what I did, I could not shake this. So this is just a kind of an example of how you can work with these things. The third hindrance is like agitation. Do you ever notice an agitated state in one's body and mind? These occur. Anxiety is another aspect of that agitation. Worry. So You know, I found myself obsessed with, if I leave this job, I won't be able to get health insurance. How can I live? Obama, hurry up, please. You know, so I'm waking up in the middle of the night thinking about all these, oh, well, what will my life be like? What will my career be like if I leave this job? So this is the kind of thing that starts to percolate. Of course, at the same time, other things are happening. The fourth one is sloth and torpor. Yeah, it's a nice one, isn't it? So I'm like, so, you know, like, I mean, I wouldn't even like sit on my couch. I'd crawl in bed with my laptop, you know, sort of lazy, ultimately lazy, you know. I'd like shave off periods, you know, zazen. And well, I'll sit for 35 minutes. Well, maybe 37, not 40, like I usually sit with. So, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, the worst thing about practice is the longer you do this, the harder it is to ignore. Like, you know, I couldn't even make excuses for myself. I'm just sitting there going, oh, okay, great. I get to sit zazen with this. Or I get to walk out of the house with this ill will following me around. And the fifth is doubt. You know, like maybe the Dharma's really stupid. Why am I doing this? Maybe I could just like go and live like a hippie in Hawaii or something. And so, you know, this profound kind of doubt. And, you know, when I talk about this, you know, I'm kind of joking. Or I'm sort of happy. Because actually, you know, I do find it at this point somewhat amusing, even though it is rather painful, which I think is part of the joy of practice. That it's hard to take myself so seriously, but it's also very disheartening to see myself caught in these things. But again, you know, I want to reiterate, watch for these things arising, these mental states, you know, sensual desire. And that doesn't just mean like some kind of sexual desire, but actually it means that your senses are, faculties are kind of grabbing on to things and fixing them. The mind is also a sense faculty in Buddhism. So your mind can get, you know, grab onto some things, juicy things. Ill will, you know, worry, anxiety, proliferation of restlessness. That's another aspect of that. The fourth, sloth and torpor, or laziness, and doubt. And I would say that you have to be very careful with these kinds of things, but the practice of withering is, I think, addressing some of the things that impede us from being open. But it doesn't, if you think like you can just like get angry at your anger, you're in trouble. So you have to find a way to maybe prune the trees, and you know, Suzuki Roshi talks about these mind weeds of setting, of composting our stuff and using them to fertilize our lives, you know. So this is just removing the defilements and clearing away taints. That's another, these are terms that sound like, oh, but we don't want to think about taints or bad things in Buddhism. But I think facing those things squarely is part of that withering process. The eyeball in the skull is being able to pay attention to it, you know, watching the withering as it goes on. And being committed to being awake even in the wasteland of difficulty. I would say the other aspect of withering is studying the self. This watching our delusions, watching our tendency to want to control things, to have a self that has an important existence. You know, this emptiness is empty of inherent self-existence. But I find myself sometimes caught in going, oh, my way. My way is the right way, right? And everybody should go along with it. Wouldn't that be great? That kind of, you know, control and aggression is the kind of thing that you want to study. And studying the self. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. Our famous line from the Genjo Koan. To study the self is to forget the self. It's to set aside these habit patterns. But not to... It's almost like I said, you compost or recycle, or they become the energy, actually, for transformation. So things wither. You know, the relentless selfishness, I think, withers. I always say, I used to think I was a nice person before I started sitting. And then I started to realize, oh, I actually want to get things from other people. You know, I might smile at somebody because I want them to like me. I want them to make me feel good. And, of course, this can be problematic because starting to see that sometimes, it's like, now what do? Can I smile at people anymore? What do I, you know? But that's kind of being off balance, you know? Sometimes it's okay. Just that's why I think you see a lot of Zen people and they get a little bit too withered. They kind of dry up and, like, you know, you say hi and they're like... You know, I was reading Grace Shearson recently wrote a book on Zen women, and somewhere in there, it's published, Tayo sent it to me, but somewhere in there she's writing and she said one of her students or friends was like at some Zen center, probably at San Francisco Zen Center, likely place, and she said, why are these Zen people so mean? And Grace said something like, well, what happened? And they said, well, I was asking someone there for some milk for my child, and nobody would give it to me. You know, refrigerator's closed, right? Snack time's over. It's not our form. And I thought, if anybody does that at Ancient Dragon, please don't ever, you know, do this. Let's not have a mean attitude. But sometimes when you wither, you know, some Zen people, they get kind of scared of interacting with other people because you see how you're trying to get something out of a situation. And so you kind of pull back and are like, I don't want to try to control things, so I just won't say anything. But even then, we're trying to get something. I'm trying to be somebody who doesn't want to get anything, you know. So you're caught in these kind of circumstances, you know. And it's just important to support each other in that practice. So sometimes if somebody's a little withered, can say hello, and if they have a hard time saying hello, go, okay. So, you know, forgetting the self, you wither away this kind of selfishness and these obstacles, these hindrances, and, you know, hopefully some blooms appear in that withered branch. We hope some kittens appear in our lives. And when we give up, you know, you can't force yourself to give up. You have to stay with all of those painful things, like, you know, wanting a better health insurance plan or wanting power, or wanting our children to be like us or wanting more money or wanting to be good and helpful to everyone. Not that that's bad, but the grasping quality kills it. So, to really understand with your whole body and mind that you don't matter, that the you that you think you are doesn't matter, is the work of many a lifetime, I think. So it might, if you don't feel like you're blooming, and even though I don't feel that way right now, there is some call forth as much faith and love and respect as possible. Maybe not this lifetime, but in the future, I'm sure each of you will bloom. So we're sitting, you know, hopefully we'll keep our eyeball, Cyclops eyeball open. And, wither away these habits, these old blessed habits based on fear, and taking refuge in the support and care of everyone around us. That's been very sustaining to me through this difficult time, coming here, coming to my friends, my family, people who love me nonetheless and hang out with me even though life is a little gritty. I think it's really important to do that. You know, the monks took refuge in each other. You know, they're walking around, they're talking to each other, they're saying, what's the way? What does that mean, dragon song? You know, there's a sense that we come together and help each other in this difficult life. However, sometimes it's important to sing a little song. Sometimes it helps to sing to the dragon. So what I'd like us to do is to stand up and sing a little song together, which is my favorite song. My favorite Zen song, if you will. And I know you're like, oh my God, I wish you'd shut up because my legs are sore. So it might take us a while to stand up, to do it at your own will and pace. Part of the performance art aspect of Zen, right? Mm-hmm. So this is what we do. You might know this. You put your whole self your whole self out. You put your whole self in and you shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey and you turn yourself around. That's what it's all about. Okay, so three times.
Three.
You put your whole self in. You put your whole self out. You put your whole self in and you shake it all about.
So the bumper sticker was right. What if the hokey pokey is what it's all about?
Absolutely. That is a great question.
So we can sit again, or if you want to remain standing, you can. But now we have the opportunity to sing back to the Tenzo.
Sing your songs, dragon.
So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Just to add to a little bit, just to recall a little bit of the song from yesterday, I started off talking about the dragon song yesterday by quoting another great old master named Hongzhe talking about spring arising in everything. So we had the equinox a couple of days ago, and of course it snowed because it's Chicago, but still we can feel the spring arising in everything. And so part of what I was talking about, in which Hogetsu has taken up again tonight, is the rhythm and the rightfulness and lawfulness of the rhythm of withering and then blossoming and everything blossoming. And this happens beyond all of those efforts to control things and get what we want. And so how do we recognize that? Anyway, I'll just add that to what, or recall that to add that on to what you said. And please feel free to respond, comment, sing your own song, question the Tenzo. Feel free.
How do you sing your songs?
Yes.
Well, I was going to say something different, but now that we've done the hokey pokey, I have to tell the story. Good friends of mine traveled to South Africa a few years ago on a cultural tour, and they would go from house to house, and wherever they were greeted, the people would sing and dance for them. That was the way they were greeted. And then they thought it was so wonderful, and then at the third place they went, they said, and now it's your turn to sing for us. And they were horrified because we don't sing and dance, and so they consulted among each other, and the only thing they knew was the hokey pokey. After the entire rest of their tour, they went around South Africa in churches and schools and hospitals singing and dancing the hokey pokey, and I guess it was a great success.
That's great. Thank you, Laurel. When in doubt, hokey pokey.
Well, it's very joyful and fun. So if that's what it's all about,
Yes.
We would be in good stead.
There are blossoms in a withered tree.
I don't know the demands of your daily schedule and life, but somehow I like the idea of you on the bed watching TV
Capricorn.
On your computer. Yeah.
But have you watched Battlestar Galactica?
I haven't. Capricorn's, you know, fast forwarded to that, but. So what do you like about that?
Because it's, I don't know, because you're not supposed to do it.
Right, because it's human, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So be careful not to feel guilty about such things, because we're only human. But also, it's important to be careful.
The Greeks have a saying, and that, since I am Greek, however my pronunciation is probably awful, I won't even get into the pronunciation, but it basically says nothing to excess. That's mm-hmm. the message, nothing
yes.
to excess. Mm-hmm. So that's the key, I think, you know, mm-hmm. when we're obsessed with something and all we can do is that, and mm-hmm. we're doing things that we find ourselves in a place where we're not nurturing ourselves, mm-hmm. And we're doing this other whatever it is, this great distraction. Then we know, you know, well, nothing to excess. Mm-hmm. Excessively doing something else rather than keeping house.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I'm Brooks.
Hi, Brooks.
Hi. I would just like to hear more about what being careful might mean. Like, I mean, I can imagine what it might mean, but I'd like to hear more about what that would mean.
It's the eye and the skull.
Mm-hmm.
So it's paying attention and not necessarily trusting every single thing that I desire. So, and checking in with one's intention. Is this in accord with my vows and my intention to support life? You know, and check in with your teacher once in a while. Say, I haven't told you about Caprica. Sorry about that.
Sorry. But, you know, it's also about, so just
yes.
to add to what
yes.
you said, we have precepts that are about this. And in some ways they boil down to the old, you know, like nothing to excess, do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
So not to harm oneself or others. And then I always like to add the positive side. How do you bring helpfulness and life and nurturance to yourself and others and the whole situation. So these are the kinds of things to check about being careful, not to cause harm, to consider all the beings involved as much as you can. But also, the thing that you were saying about, or maybe Adam was saying, is that you shouldn't do that. Well, we all have ideas of things we should and do. And that's not part of being careful. So
noticing that as being careful.
Yes. So be careful not to get caught by the things that we think we should or shouldn't do because our mommy said so, or the TV said so, or, you know, we have all these ideas. Sometimes it's good to just crawl into your bed and, I don't know, watch your computer. I don't know. We need to be kind and nurturing to ourselves. And that means not falling for the shoulds and shouldn'ts. But then there is this kind of standard of being careful, like, well, what, not to no excess is a good one, trying to be helpful, not causing harm, paying attention to the whole situation, again, the eye and the skull, pay attention to the confusion we're feeling. So as Hogetsu was saying, to be upright in the middle of this withering is actually a very dynamic reality, and this is from whence the blossoms arise eventually.
So the withering isn't necessarily aging, because first I thought about it like it was a singing inside of an aging person, but that's probably what I'm thinking about. And then there was the definition of withering that was more like someone who's meditated a lot might be way too withered, like they're just not, they're afraid to interact with anyone, to bring out their humanity.
Right.
So what is, so the withering is more of the, what is the withering?
It's still being alive, but also there is a sense, I think, of... that rhythm maybe that, that Teigen talks about, that part of renewal is also death or giving up.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say a withering is letting go, perhaps, of leaves when their time has passed.
Mm-hmm.
But Brooks, this is, it's a really good point to think, what is withering? You know, and what's too much withering? Because there can be, there can be a withering of like, oh, I just don't care about this anymore. Or there's a withering of, you know, I'm detached. You know, nirvana is extinction, right? Or extinguishing. That's blowing out. And, you know, I think that, that it can be misunderstood. You know, Buddha's nirvana is he's dead, right? But that's not our nirvana. You know, it might be being alive with seeing the whole picture at once. So the seeing the aliveness in death. But there is a willingness to let go of some things that we hold on to. I think especially, well, I wouldn't say especially, actually. I think it was more acute earlier in practice how much holding on there is. But I think it, your awareness of that, the I gets more acute in noticing the subtleties as practice increases. So I think you're always keeping an eyeball on this, what's extra, what's interfering with my intention, and what's covering my connection to the world.
And to the part that I was talking about of that yesterday, since we were doing an all-day sitting, is how this is a model for the rhythm of our practice, exactly just sitting as being still and allowing, you know, the quietness. And out of that stillness and out of the withered tree, there's blossoming, there's a rising of energy. So there's a rhythm, you know, those of us who are old and for those who are young, the in our life, you know, in the seasons, but also in our own cycles in our life, there's this kind of stopping and settling and stilling and quietness. And out of that, some life comes. So there's always that rhythm. And this is about, and what Hogetsu is talking about tonight, is paying attention to that.
So, Tanya, one time you said that you take requests, so I'd put this out there for either one of you for a talk sometime about doubt. It's, Hogetsu, you said sometimes these frustrating times are the most productive eventually. And I've had people say that to me, oh, you're having doubts? Oh, good. Now you're really getting somewhere or something like that. I'm not quite sure I get it all. But I do know that, you know, sometimes everything seems right and sometimes the doubt is sort of a powerful force. I can't tell how productive it is.
Well, it can be not productive, actually.
Yeah.
That's, these hindrances are not productive.
Right.
You know, you can work with them, but I, that's why I say to be careful, because it is very, I think this is one reason why people tend to have this detached kind of, you know, people shut down or this stillness, is that it's a slippery slope, you know, doubt. Like you can go, oh, doubt, that's really good. But if it's not productive, it's debilitating and it interferes with practice. And, you know, these hindrances are interferences. And there are many things that, many more things that are, you know, delusions are endless. Being stuck in these mind states and mental habits are, they're relentless. They do not go away. The self that is trying to assert its power over the entire world is never going away, as far as I know. It's like a pet that, you know, that thing is not staying trained no matter what you do. It still pees on the carpet. And, you know, there's, so you have to learn how to live with that. But I agree that doubt is not always, and sometimes it's like, what do you mean doubt is helpful? It feels awful. And also it stopped. I'm not practicing now, or I'm, you know, and practicing isn't just sitting zazen, but it's, you know, I'm forgetting my intention, you know, or I'd lose sight of it because I'm doubting my way away from it. And I think that one of the reasons that, you know, we have the precepts, and certainly in early Buddhism, there was a lot of talk about, you know, how do you work with taints and obstructions and defilements, and, you know, really kind of putting a straitjacket on people, you know, all these rules of Vinaya. But, you know, we're sort of still beastie, you know. Even beasts have probably more consideration than I do many times as a human. And so it's a lot of work, and you can't just like force yourself out of doubt, but to approach it, but not get sucked into it, because it's like quicksand. If you struggle with it, you sink deeper. But that's a good question and a good thing to explore, and it can be hurtful, I think, if somebody, a teacher, doesn't take your doubt seriously. You know, serious business.
So is it your sense then that through sitting that one's doubt becomes more manageable?
Make friends with it,
mm-hmm.
but you keep it in its place.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, that's true for each kind of afflictive emotion or habit pattern, out of control habit pattern, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean these things go away, but the relationship is different.
Mm.
You know, if you meet it with, your intention is more deeply rooted.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as, you know, might not spin out. But I think still careful, because it's easy to, a hair's breadth deviation and you're out of tune. So you can slip into that very quickly, I think.
And there's also the transformation of these negative qualities. So doubt does transform with awareness to, well, there's a whole process of questioning that's a constructive questioning.
Mm-hmm.
And doubt is, and actually doubt and questioning is necessary to faith and to will and to intention. So I'm going to talk about this in 2 weeks.
So the transform quality of doubt is like clarity.
Clarity and faith and trust.